Straighten up now, this ain't no joke. Come on out and smell the smoke. Keep your eyes out wide and clear. Hard times coming down around here. Battlefield this old hometown. The neighborhoods are burning down. Coming up on a last leg. Welcome to the powder keg. Don't you see? We saw the wages of history. And don't you see? We saw the wages of history. White man's town plantation laws, symptomatic long time cause, and brutality a social norm, all dressed up in a badge and a uniform. You should have seen them laugh and strut, carving notches in their pistol butts, trusting to impunity, and never thought they'd wind up on TV. Don't you know, don't you see? These are the wages of history, and don't you know, don't you see? These are the wages of history. It was a bad call by a bad design, a foolish move by a foolish mind. Banking on the master race, it was bound to blow up in somebody's face. All those troops in armor barrage, soldiers wearing camouflage, just got back from the Middle East, now dodging bullets in the streets of Los Angeles. These are the wages of history, and don't you see? These are the wages of history. Celebrity, money is another reality. Look out, posted out in the yard. Say, it looks like we got trouble coming up the boulevard. Marie Antoinette with a facelift, hearing that the people say they have no justice. Looking out the window to the valley of dread. What's the matter with them? Was it something I said? Don't you see? These are the wages of history. And don't you see? These are the wages of history. Now every empire must decay. Even Rome didn't fall in a day. Plaster cracks in fits and starts, and finally just falls apart. The new day breaks with a great surprise. It shines so bright it will hurt your eyes. Painful like a laboring birth. Well, welcome to the planet Earth. Don't you see? These are the wages of history. And don't you see? These are the wages of history.
Listening to Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBO Community Radio. Coming at you out of Southeast Portland, my name's Paul Rowland. Be with you till 9 o'clock, at which point Political Perspectives comes your way. The Project Censored Show, Ralph Nader speaks about his book Breaking Through Power. And we just heard Seattle's own Jim Page from 1993 CD, More Than Anything Else in the World. And I wanted to let that run through just because I didn't remember all the lyrics, and it just got better and better. Really holds up well. The song was actually written in response to the Rodney King beating, and that's one of the really early instances where a police beating of an African-American person was captured on video before cell phones, and went viral and led to a massive reaction. People called riots and military response, and a situation we know all too well from recent years. But I think those lyrics held up really well. You also heard that the police just got the police ex-military just got back from the Middle East. Very resonant. And of course, they were involved in the first Gulf War, which led by President George Bush Sr. And that led to Bush Jr.'s insane invasion of Iraq, which you just heard on Democracy Now, if you were listening, was completely and absolutely a massive historical mistake. So we're going to be talking about the wages of history on the show today. You know, it's wintertime is a good time to take stock of things. Traditionally, in traditional societies, it's a time for telling stories, sort of touching base with the wellsprings of the people, the creation stories, the stories that hold the people together, going back to the kind of collective perspective, something that we lose sight of in the society. It's a good time to take stock together of where we're at, and I know that that's something we're all doing since the election, and not before, trying to figure out where we're at, where we're going, how to respond. A lot of people are still somewhat in shock from the, not just the election itself, but obviously what has ensued since, all the implications. Again, you heard on Democracy Now! The conflict of interest. One needs to ask the question, does Trump really intend to address these conflicts of interest? Does he see them as conflicts of interest? Like probably many of you, I've been reading somewhat obsessively articles on my favorite websites and others about the implications of this. Just a few titles. I'm going to be talking about these, and hopefully you will want to talk about them with me. A White Nationalist Counter-Revolution by Gregory Smithers, who's a history professor from Virginia Commonwealth University, I believe, posted on December 23rd in Counterpunch, is where I read it. A very interesting article, The Political Theorist. This political theorist predicted the rise of Trumpism. His name was Hunter S. Thompson. In Hell's Angels, the Gonzo journalist wrote about left behind people motivated only by, quote, an ethic of total retaliation. Sound familiar? By Susan McWilliams. I believe I read that also in Counterpunch. I'm not sure. These things just sort of pop up. I know I should write down their source. Another one, will Trump's rule of law be our rule of law? The fate of the entire legal apparatus of government is in the balance. By Dahlia, like the flower, D-A-H-L-I-A, Lithwick, L-I-T-H-W-I-C-K. Just read the first paragraph. I might just read the first paragraph or two from some of these, spur some, and then sort of share some of my, what I consider deeper thoughts. America has surprised herself Wednesday morning by democratically electing to its highest political office a man with no record of government service and a temperament built of equal parts vengeance and viciousness. America has elected a man who is likely uncheckable as a matter of personality and ensured that he is also uncheckable as a matter of constitutional democracy by giving him control of the House, the Senate, and the federal judicial branch. I suspect we will come to learn fairly quickly whether the same Republicans who said they deplored Trump's words and actions but supported and endorsed him anyhow will now act to oppose him as president. I believe they are utterly terrified of him. Now more than ever, he would have accepted nothing less of them. Like Andrew Solomon, I hold out very little hope that most Republicans in Congress will be anything but supine for President Trump as he begins to unspool his broad, unspecified plans to unilaterally dismantle the First Amendment protections for journalists, even though he has no authority to do so. I don't believe he will build a wall and make Mexico pay for it, but I don't believe the new Congress would stand up to him to stop that, or his reinstitution of torture, or his immigration dragnets if he wanted to try. I believe that if President Trump instructs his special prosecutor Chris Christie or Rudy Giuliani to find a way to lock Hillary Clinton up, he would do so gleefully. And then many millions of people will look on and feel that justice, whatever that means going forward, was done. And it goes on from there. Of course, I've talked about that. Other people have talked about that. That's the nature of fascism, is to throw out the carefully built up institutions of the rule of law, however flawed and criticized, including on this program, they may be. From an indigenous perspective, as we've discussed with my co-host Jacqueline Keeler, the origins of federal Indian law in the completely skewed doctrine of discovery, which still really is in place as a foundation of the Constitution itself, because the United States was founded on the idea of the United States being basically God's gift to the world, that the first so-called Christian European nation to discover a territory was the rightful owners of that territory. So the first foundation stone of this nation was based upon a lie and deceit, or from the community rights perspective, that the Commerce Clause of the Constitution is basically the cornerstone for all of commercial and corporate development and control, that was really the intention of the founders to make this a commercial establishment. It was, after all, founded as a corporation. The colonies were corporations. Again, the wages of history. So another few articles: what those who studied Nazis can teach us about the strange reaction to Donald Trump. Well, it's important to watch the president-elect closely. We also must be mindful of our own response to him. First paragraph: Jewish American political thinker Hannah Arendt, who escaped Germany in 1933, saw the problem as not what our enemies did, but what our friends did. On election night, MSNBC's Chris Matthews had a revelation. Matthews, with a pained expression, began to piece together the basis for Hillary Clinton's pending defeat. She had failed to communicate a tough position on illegal immigration. She had supported bad trade deals. She had not renounced all of the stupid wars. Her presidential rival, Donald Trump, on the other hand, had waged what Matthews called a, quote, legitimate campaign on these issues, a claim that seemed to stretch the bounds of legitimacy. But Matthews was not alone. In the following days and weeks, others would make similar claims, implying a victory that weeks before had been impossible was actually inevitable, and liberalism was largely to blame. It goes on from there. Again, how journalists covered the rise of Mussolini and Hitler. Reports on the rise of fascism in Europe was not the American media's finest hour. That's from the Smithsonian magazine, or online anyway, originally published in a site called The Conversation by John Browich from December 13. I could read some of this, but let's go on. So these are things I've been thinking about. And I've been also reading the book called American Leviathan, Empire, Nation, and Revolutionary Frontier. The dark and bloody ground of the frontier during the years of the American Revolution created much that we associate with the idea of America. Between 1763 and 1795, Westerners not only participated in a war of independence, but also engaged in a revolution that ushered in fundamental changes in social relations, political allegiances, and assumptions about the relationship between individuals and society. In the West, that means the Ohio Valley. At the time, the process was stripped down to its essence. Settlers struggled with the very stuff of revolution, violence, uncertainty, competition, and frenzied and contradictory attempts to reestablish order. As the American nation superseded the British Empire on the frontier, common men and women were transformed into deferential subjects, from deferential subjects into self-sovereign citizens, kind of like the Malheur occupiers. But something more profound was at work. The violent nature of the contest to reconstitute sovereignty produced a revolutionary settlement riddled with what we would regard as paradox, in which new notions of race went hand in hand with new definitions of citizenship. This was not a settlement created by a founding elite and imposed from above. In the almost Hobbesian state of nature that the West had become, Westerners created a liberating yet frightening vision of what society was to be. Amid escalating bloodshed, the common people demanded a new West, and an American Leviathan brought this new world into being. Through this revolutionary process, settlers helped shape the contradictory nature of that American state and fashion some of the myths that made America American. That's from another professor who was actually at the University of Virginia at the time he wrote this, Patrick Griffin. That's American Leviathan Empire Nation and Revolutionary Frontier. So as you peel back the onion of what's happening to us today, you find some origins that set the stage for what's happening. Now, does that help us respond to what's happening? That's the big question. Can we learn from history? So I want to talk about these things. I know that it's difficult to talk about deep historical frameworks and analysis in an hour-long talk show format, but perhaps there are people out there who thirst for this sort of perspective. And I'm not saying I really am providing this perspective. I'm trying to provide a little bit of sort of some starting points for discussion, a little bit of a framework. Another thing that I've been thinking about is the idea of progressivism. It's so inherent in sort of what I consider the quote liberal, as opposed to what I consider a quote radical perspective, which is that there is this sort of historical progress, you know, that things are generally getting better. I know on his talk show yesterday, my fellow talk show host, Joe Uris, an excellent program, by the way, said that, you know, Trump threatens to roll back the gains of the New Deal. Okay, but we have to look at these things in a deeper context. And I know this is very difficult because we're conditioned by the times that we live in and by the very real limitations of time and energy and sometimes education, sometimes our peer groups. We're limited by a lot of things in terms of our ability to really grasp in greater depth what's actually going on with us socially. But so the problem with progressivism is these gains are basically reactions to previous crises. My view of history, I'll just lay it out there, is that basically historical, you know, whether it's warfare, whether it's landmark legislation, whether it's large social movements, revolutions, they all tend to react and try to resolve a crisis that was just created by previous crises. So where did it all begin? I think we really do eventually need to do that, but it takes some time, some discipline, people around you who are willing to do that. I think I have serious doubts whether we'll actually resolve this seemingly final crisis, whether in when you're talking about climate change, we're talking about species loss, we're talking about the lack of oxygen in the ocean. There's a mass fish die-off just in the past couple weeks up on the eastern shore of Canada. Just massive numbers of sea creatures. And the idea is that that's the lack of oxygen, which is the result of increasing temperature and increasing carbon dioxide absorption by the oceans. Whether it's that, whether it's the seemingly looming rise of a semi-fascist, neo-fascist government under Donald Trump, which threatens to throw away whatever veneer or however you view it as or very real gains of regulatory, environmental, social, workplace regulation, the whatever checks there are on the use of the military in the 50 states in the domestic United States, the mass surveillance, whatever way you look at it, there seems to be multiple intersecting crises. And as I say, I despair. But if we are going to respond to it, it has to be at a level that's not just addressing the crises created by the current situation, because as I say, they multiply upon themselves. So anyway, I've thrown a lot of things out there. I'm willing to read a little bit more from some of the things I said or lay out some more of my ideas. I'd like to engage with you and engage in a conversation that builds upon these things that I have put out there. I don't think that it's just because I think it's important. I think I'm a sensitive and thoughtful person who has come up with some ideas that are worth considering. Of course, this is my talk show, so I guess I get to say, but now is your chance to join in and take this somewhere. Could be a slightly different place, but I really would like to people to do their best to address some of the things that I brought up and make this move. We're not really used to conversation in this culture as much as perhaps some other cultures and times. I think of, you know, salon culture leading up to the French Revolution. You know, I don't know, maybe that's a romanticized myth. But the number to call in is 503-231-8187. I'm sure you don't want to hear me talk for the entire hour. If there's something you would like me to clarify about some things I said, if you're kind of interested in where I'm going with this, and I would be willing to continue, but I would like to engage with you. The number is 503-231-8187. I think this article on Hunter S. Thompson is pretty interesting. You know, of course, so what really struck me, I guess I'll just say, is that I read these series of articles, and then I picked up this book I had picked up several months ago, American Leviathan. And it starts out with this figure of Tom Quick, who was a frontiersman in Western Pennsylvania who, well, let me just read, since no one's calling in, 503-231-8187. From the 7 Years' War through the American Revolution until the Whiskey Rebellion, a frontiersman haunted the American imagination. Growing up in the on the Pennsylvania frontier as the eldest of 10, Tom Quick was one of those faceless, poorer men squatting on holding small tracts and struggling to achieve competency. I understand Karen just called in. Just hold off a second. Let me just finish this paragraph. Something, however, set him apart from his neighbors. Tom Quick had pledged to exterminate every Indian he came across. Before 1763, he did not seem destined to become an Indian slayer. Like many young boys in the frontier, he hunted, fished, and played with young Delawares in the woods around the cabin his father had built, counting them among his closest friends. That is, until the end of the French and Indian War, when a young Delaware shot and scalped his father, stripping him of his silver cufflinks and shoe buckles. His father's murder transformed Tom Quick. "The blood of the whole Indian race," he repeatedly declared, "is not sufficient to atone for the blood of my father." Tom Quick then promised to kill 100 Delawares before he died. So, of course, one must understand the context in which a Delaware Indian shot and scalped his father, and the origins of scalping by the settlers themselves, at least the escalation of the practice and this reaction and counter-reaction that developed, and who was really driving the warfare and the increasing desperation of the indigenous peoples as they were forced to confront this growing empire that illegally stripped them of their lands and resources. And the inability of the individuals caught up in that to, again, to have that greater context, that the reactionary mechanism set in. And of course, I thought of Donald Trump and his followers when I thought of this figure of Tom Quick. But let's go to Karen. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning, Paul. Yes, thank you for your wonderful introduction. I followed along on the Dahlia Lithwick article. And I wanted to go there as part of my reason for calling, and that is that Robert Reich had suggested that we sue Donald Trump, which sounds great, but nothing specific in this first 100 days article that he had online. And I was thinking that Donald Trump's major problem right now is, of course, the emoluments clause of the Constitution, and I don't know how we sue, because that seems to me to be in the arena of impeachment, although I know very little about the legal ways of trying to challenge this administration, this incoming one. I also was thinking that something like 100 judiciary seats were not filled by President Obama because of Republican obstruction, which sets us up in the courts for diminished effectiveness for sure. And so I was wondering if you had ideas about what Robert Reich was thinking around suing. And I realized that the institution of the courts is weakened. That's also a part of this. As for your last point, right before you picked up my conversation with you, I think that we have narcissistic entitlement as whites in this culture, and Donald Trump is the most malignant expression of that, and we need to be allies and form coalitions with people of color and Muslim folks and all the people that are going to be women, people who are going to be affected most brutally by this incoming administration. So I would like to take your reply off the air, if that's okay.
Sure, you might just hang on for a little bit, because I'm not sure how up for it I am. I guess I'll just, something I've sort of wanted to say, maybe I've said in the past, is, you know, being a talk show host, you sort of put yourself in the position of being, you know, if not an expert, at least someone who is called upon to sort of pronounce upon these things. And I feel woefully unprepared for that task, as I think we all are really feeling for the situation. So, you know, I don't know if you heard Democracy Now! Talk about this issue, that constitutional issue, that there was the first segment that they had, that they laid out, you know, all these conflicts of interest. They didn't address it at the issue of like how, I mean, they basically addressed it at the issue of, yes, it has to be done, you know, and the guy was sort of, I thought, was altogether sort of too airy, you know, about this sort of the idea that Donald Trump is actually feeling the need to do this. I question, you know, I said that at the outset, I question whether he really even sees these as conflicts of interest. I mean, that's, you know, that, you know, when you start talking about the idea of fascism, that's what fascism is. There's no more a distinction between the private, commercial, business, corporate interests and the state structure, you know, and that is essentially what the challenge that Trump is presenting. So yeah, I do not know the answer to that question. I do not know what Robert Reich was talking about, the idea of suing. I do not know, you know, if it comes to impeachment, I mean, is there the will or the energy for that? I frankly see it as a pretty grim situation. So I'm more go to the, you know, the idea of what you're talking about with, you know, forming alliances and, you know, fighting this at the grassroots level. Because the institutional level, you know, yeah, of course, people have to, you know, we have to be, you know, doing whatever we can, whether it's individuals filing suit, you know, class action suit, whether it's, you know, whoever the remaining brave Democrats might be to, you know, to bring, you know, impeachment proceedings. Yeah, all those things have to be done. But, you know, that it has to be, we can't rely. I mean, I think what this, if this doesn't drive home any other point, it drives home the point that the only people we can rely upon are those of us who really feel this most directly.
I agree with you, Paul, everything you just said, and those are all the conclusions, or at least tentative conclusions, I've come to myself. The ultimate failure of the institutions, that such as the courts and even the Congress, because of course we're way outnumbered, and that we have to form coalitions amongst the people that are going to be most affected. And I think we will get some people will be activated when they start tearing the social safety net up, and which is a horrible thing to say, that that's what will happen. But it appears that the Republicans have always been after that social safety net, and it's not just Donald Trump. It's been their design not to have that social safety net. So, I mean, there's a bit of me that's still bitter that it was unrecognized by a lot of progressives, just how awful it would be not to have liberals. Just that I want only liberals. I don't. I was a Bernie fan. But that there is a really big difference between what we're going to get from Trump and what we would have gotten from Clinton.
Yeah, well, water under the bridge at this point. But thank you for calling. And we do have a couple more callers, and hopefully this conversation will continue as good as it has started. So thank you, Karen. So Will, I think, is the next caller. You still there? Go ahead.
Yeah, hey, Paul. How you doing? I really loved what you said in the beginning of the show. It was pretty it hit a lot of stuff, obviously. I agree. I think that the problems that we have now can't be discussed in bumper sticker type, you know, 2 second snapshots of blurbs. What has happened in this country and much of the world, but specifically United States, we are at stage 5 cancer at this point. We are at the terminal stage of cancer stage of actually unfettered capitalism. But it's even worse than that. By design, we have a country mostly populated with people that have absolutely no idea what the difference is between the commons and private property is. They've so blurred the line. They don't. Most people, I mean, I want to speak. Obviously, there are exceptions. Don't even understand what the commons are anymore. They don't understand that it is completely incompatible to have a government that doesn't protect and respect our commons. That's one thing. And also, by design, and it was the Republicans that completely wiped out all civics training, training from high school and junior high school. So and earlier. So we have a population of people that have little to no understanding of civics, and because of that, we are now set up, custom made for, well, what we're getting, which is a fascist form of oligarchy. We're there actually already. I would argue that we're not going in that direction. I would say that we're already there, and of course then we have a media that is a monopoly media that actually has no interest whatsoever in education or civics responsibility. They're just out to make money. That's the beginning and end of everything that they consider. So we are in some deep, deep doo-doo here, because we have, not only are we in the grips of an oligarchy that is clearly fascist, it ain't going to be easy getting out at this point. So, but I don't know what else to say, but I know we have to try, but it's
well, so what are your steps?
Well, the only thing that I've been doing for many years, actually, is basically all I can do is one person, and I do it, and so a lot of people I do know, Elsa, I know do. We have to become the media ourselves. We can't, literally, I mean, your shows like yours and, you know, Tom Hartman and, you know, Amy Goodman, et cetera, are doing a fantastic job. But you're so unbelievably outnumbered. I mean,
Here, I'd like to, on that note, here's something that I've thought of for a while. For many years, Portland had what I thought was a pretty good example of, you know, an alternative newspaper in the Portland Alliance, and unfortunately like the year before I came back to Portland, it stopped printing. I think there's some good reporting in the Portland Tribune. I think the Portland Mercury has some good reporting. But as a whole, they're mainly, well, at least certainly the Willamette Week and the Mercury are mainly, you know, entertainment weeklies that they focus on that. And they, you know what they can fit in. They have some good hard news. The Portland Tribune is a bit of a different beast. It seems to have trended slightly more towards decent investigative reporting recently, but none of them really represent what I try to represent and what I think, you know, Democracy Now! And, you know, to some extent, KBOO as a whole represents, which is a more radical, regular print publication. So I'd like to challenge Portlanders to maybe come up with, in the spirit of what you just said, come up with something like that. I'd like to see Portland Indie Media maybe come back in maybe in some other form, some really good. I know that the Portland Assembly is the response of certain sectors of the radical community in Portland, which is not a media, but maybe will develop some of its own media. It's had its first meeting last week. It's going to have its second meeting coming up. It's an attempt to do to some extent what Seattle is doing, which is organizing on a neighborhood basis, sort of groups of resilience and resistance, but also have a more of a collective assembly about how to respond to the situation. So you can look up their Facebook page, Portland Assembly. I'll probably be talking about that more on my show as we see how it develops. But so yeah, that's my one thought is people do need to step up and fill in those roles and make things happen. You know, make things happen. Do DIY culture, websites, blogs, alternative papers. So yeah, step up.
There is one thing I completely agree with what you're saying, and I'm actually doing that. There is one but, though. I'd like to throw in one but, if you don't mind. Uh-huh. Everything what you just said is spot on. I would disagree with one thing. We are not radicals. This is where I think we have to be very careful with our language. In fact, we need to change our language. I don't consider you a radical at all, and I certainly don't consider myself a radical. There's nothing radical about being an FDR type, whatever you want to call it, a progressive. That's actually dead in the center.
I don't consider myself an FDR.
Well, you may not, but even if you're to the left of that, you know, in many ways, you're still not a radical. The reason why I'm bringing this up is what a radical is on the left is we need to pull back. We need to win back our language. A radical on the left, and that's not a bad thing, is someone who's what you might say, is, at least economically, is a communist, a member of the Communist American Party, which is a very real party. And there's nothing wrong with that. I'm just saying, because of propaganda, people that are generally in the majority of thinking in this country are now considered not only the left, but often the far left. And that's another problem, too. Everything has shifted so far to the right that it's pulled everything with it. I didn't mean to imply that you're an FDR Democrat.
But
the point is that I don't consider, from what I know about you or myself, I mean, I don't consider you a radical at all.
Well, let me just respond to that really quickly, and then we'll get on to Suzanne, who's next on the line here. So radical, I consider that reclaiming the language. I mean, maybe it just is so, it's been so corrupted by its perversion in the popular culture and by the right wingers, radical, or you know, so there's some people consider right wingers radical. I don't, but radical to me means going to the root. That's the root of the word radical. So going to the root, and that's what I mean. That's why I'm trying to bring in a deep historical perspective by really, you know, I try to go in depth. I think we've lost depth by the superficialization of the culture, the society, the spectacle that we live in. So thank you so much for calling, Will. You've added other dimensions, and hopefully we will continue in this vein. So thank you for calling. Next up is Suzanne. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. I have several points, Tal, and I'll go through them quickly. One is a reminder that the English language is the language of business and law, and that is known internationally. I happen to be a writer, so I go deep into words. So getting mired in words gets to be a pit. resort to sign language. Use face-to-face. We have an enormous number of citizens who have attention deficit disorder now, thanks to all of the gadgets, et cetera, et cetera. So using words, and you use far too many, you talk way too long, and what's happened as I've listened to your show this morning, I get bored and I get, oh my gosh, I've lost my way in your words.
Well, unfortunately, it's a talk show, so I'm not sure how to...
Wait,
okay.
Listen to me.
I am.
Hear me. Hear me. There's a huge difference between listening and hearing. When you hear somebody, you respond immediately and with flexibility, and you switch the subject instantly to what might be your solution, listener. You have a wealth of knowledge about the past and all of that, but human beings live concurrently in the past, the present, and the future. That's the way we're born, and that's what happens. And this, I want you to succeed, but right now you're talking like a college professor, which is what I usually fell asleep in most of the time in college. If you can break it up and flip it over to your listeners quickly and say, anybody, what's happened? My one question, I have several, who sits at your dinner table? Who are the people that really sit down with you? And because unless to know is to do, to not do is to not know. So that means the people that give us on the ground reality with their hearts and their brains are great teachers, and they're very quick. It's not, I'm not going to go into all the service work I've done here and there and everywhere. I'm not important, but the importance is now. Now. And what, who, and how. I'm doing...
Well, listen, you're not really actually, to my ears, I'm listening to what you're saying. I don't feel like you're actually adding to the conversation that's already developed with my first two previous calls. Okay. Bye-bye. Okay. Well, thank you for that. So our next caller is Sylvia. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, good morning. Well, thank you for the conversation. I also want to say thank you for all the music you play in the morning. It's absolutely fantastic. I just want to make a quick comment regarding Donald Trump. I mean, this has been going on now for a while. My gut feeling is, I just went blank.
Something else.
Oh, no.
Well, maybe you can call back.
I'm sorry. I can't believe it. Okay. I'm sorry. Okay. Bye.
All right. Well, that happens to all of us. It hopefully it doesn't happen to me. It has happened to me on the air, but it's a lot worse when you're the host of the show. But that's no problem. Don't worry. Call back. So let's go to Jeff. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning. I'm enjoying your show. I just wanted to follow up on an earlier caller with a thought. And if he says that the speaking about radical, and I just wanted to suggest the radical majority after the silent majority of Mr. Nixon, I think we are the radical majority.
Okay.
Just a suggestion.
Go ahead.
All
right. I've thrown out some ideas there. And some people have taken me up on them, and that's good. Obviously, if you have another compelling direction to take the conversation in, I'm certainly willing to entertain that. But my response to the situation that we're in is, like I said, to go to things like the Portland Assembly, to obsessively read and try to make sense of what's going on. To answer the question of the previous caller to challenge me to say who I eat a dinner with? Well, it's basically me and my elderly mother, who might be interested, might be listening to this conversation, who thankfully still has her wits pretty much about her. And so we do have some interesting conversations. And she's a lifelong liberal, and so more or less can understand what I'm saying. But anyway, so I'd like to have a more extended circle. I'd like to have a salon to talk about this stuff. I do think we need to bring back, you know, the salon, cafe society, real intense, impassioned, engaged conversation. And that's something that I try to do on this program. And again, I you know, we have to step up. I step up every Wednesday morning and do this show. I feel like I've added something to the social and political culture of Portland since I've been doing it. I hope that's true. I do. If I'm always open to further suggestions, I really like to hear. I've opened it up to a once a month co-host, Jacqueline Keeler, to bring the indigenous perspective more directly, certainly than I can do since I'm not. I have had a lot of experience. You know, I talked about this book, American Leviathan, in this, which talks about the really the what set the stage for what we're going through right now. The contradictions of the colonization of this land and of the establishment of the United States have never been resolved. Every attempt to resolve them has, yes, led to some incremental progress, but has never resolved the overarching problem, which just gets worse. So my ancestors were there, actually fought in the so-called French and Indian Wars. So I feel this direct connection through my mother's family history. I think that's something that we do have to do as we're trying to be allies or accomplices, as is a different term that people use, with indigenous people and with African Americans, with other people of color, with as a male, with women, as a heterosexual, with queer and gay folks, all the people who receive the most brutal end of the unresolved contradictions of this culture, whether it's our own repression, whether it's our own tendencies towards domination, whatever it might be. So we have to understand ourselves first and foremost. So I've tried to do that. That's something that I've dedicated myself to. I challenge other people to do that. So we got our next caller, I believe, is it Jeff? Or no, we got Jeff. Camilo. Go ahead, Camilo.
Hi. Well, if it's any assurance to you, I can tell you that your work, your radio program, your efforts to do what you're doing today have certainly affected me as one individual. It was your bringing Guy McPherson to town that really made me sensitive to what's going on in the world of climate. And I appreciate the approach that you're taking, asking us to think deeply and to recognize in our own behavior, our own consciousness, what our sense of the truth is. And I think the other aspect of what you've said in terms of the historical references, that essentially history represents the latest crisis trying to resolve the previous crisis, points out that dealing with the phenomena of politics is really not sufficient. That what you point out about dealing with our own consciousness of affairs and our own specific involvement in them is what's important. And then taking that consciousness to beyond, to the community, to affiliations and organization. And what I am trying to do is to recognize this, recognize that also in terms of what you framed about the law, is that the law is really the creation of the political current. And what we're dealing now is a challenge because the currents are controlled, dominated essentially by greed. And it's only going to be fundamental philosophical questions that are going to be able to turn people's attention to things that are profound and hopefully lead to change. And I think one writer who encapsulates much of what you've tried to characterize is Gary Snyder, and Gary Snyder's concept of eco-Buddhism, which incorporates environmentalism, radical politics, and the fundamental values of Buddhism. And I think awareness of that is important. And what I am doing personally is trying to bring that to the attention of my Sangha in Shambhala, and then to bring it to other Shambhalas, other Buddhist Sanghas in the community, and other secular and faith groups, and try to create some degree of harmony. And then once we can have some degree of understanding, to try to reach beyond and to the people whose hearts we need to try to turn with this basic information.
Right on. I'm all for it. I think that's an example of stepping up and engaging, which is really, of course, how you engage is obviously a big thing. And it sounds like you're on the right path. So thank you very much. And I'm glad that I was able to help in sensitizing you. That's obviously what I do this for. I mean, just, it's not a question of just getting information out there. It's actually talking about things in a way that hopefully makes sense to people. So thank you.
You succeeded with me.
All right. Thank you, Camilo.
Bye-bye.
All right. And we got just 5 minutes left. Coming up this morning at KBOO, as I said, at 9, it's the Project Censored show on political perspectives. Ralph Nader speaks about his book, Breaking Through Power. At 10 is Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, featuring highlights from the Cannabis Cash and Public Banking Conference. At 11, Radio Zine presents gay rights attorney Elizabeth Schwartz and her book, Before I Do, outlining the practical considerations couples should address before tying the knot. And at 11:30, Talk Nation Radio brings you Richard Cahan on the forced removal and incarceration of Japanese immigrant Americans during World War II. Again, speaking of the wages of history. So do we have any more callers? Looks like we got one more caller to bring in, maybe two. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hello.
Is that me? Oh, good morning, Paul. I wanted to second what that nice fellow said pertaining to your efforts. It's clear that you work hard and you communicate very well. And I want to thank Kathleen Stevenson, because when I first came back to listening to KBOO, a lot of the subjects I felt like were kind of over my head. But gradually, through her careful selection of what she brought to us, I was able to enter further and further into a larger intellectual, you know, framework of thought. And you do the same. So, and you do so much. You do so much, and your music is also beautiful. And so I applaud you, and I'm very grateful for so much. Your efforts are very big and very important. I think maybe as far as words, having to be careful about words, or maybe being less careful about words, maybe we're all looking for a permaculture culture instead of a, you know, disposable throwaway culture, which is largely been thrown away. I mean, and we still have a resource base within ourselves and within nature to work with, and so we're going to have to get down to that. If there's a gathering place where people can come maybe twice a month or once a week and gather around a pot of potluck soup and bring their own dishes, nobody else should have to wash their dishes, then we can get acquainted with one another, and nobody's perfect. The thing is that people are coming with a heart to draw together to strengthen that heart. And I think housing and health care and sustainability is important, and I envision a day where we will be building our own communities that do have sustainable housing for people and do provide even on-site child care and elder care and gardening opportunities, because what is the point of housing a family overnight in a shelter, providing money so that they're not sleeping in their car for one night or out on the streets, because the long-term trajectory for their survivability beyond the generosity of the Christmas season is very, very poor. People have got to have housing. If you don't have the prospect of housing, you don't have the prospect of a future for your people. And I think we will get around all of this, but we do need to have a gathering place where we can meet and start working out our solutions. We're working out solutions, and I'd offer the place where I'm living and working out here, which is sizable, but we're under such an onslaught of crime that we can't do anything right now, but perhaps that will continue to improve. It has improved somewhat.
Well, we're almost out of time here. Thank you for calling. So your call is for gathering places. I know the Social Justice Action Center, formerly the Red and Black Cafe, is one such place. So again, the call is for people to step up and help make things happen, whatever they might be. So thank you for that. Unfortunately, we're not going to be able to go to Ruth because really there's only 45 seconds left, and I don't think you'd be able to get in. So call next week, Ruth, sorry, and call early. All listeners, don't wait for the last 5 or 10 minutes of the show, please, because we do want to hear what you have to say, and we don't want to have to rush it. So I've brought up many different things. Someone who wrote me an email suggested I use less "us." So I've been very conscious of that. I hope that's been noticed. It's a work in progress. All of this is a work in progress. So stay tuned for more good programming here on KBOO Community Radio, where we do step up and try to make things happen. And I'm just one voice among many. My email address is paulrkboo@gmail. That's the one I use for this show. paulrkboo@gmail.com if you want to get in touch with me, or you can get in touch with me through our website, kboo.fm, where you can re-listen to this show and get all the various links to the articles and stuff that I mentioned. I got to get out of here. We have 30 seconds left. Thank you, Liam, for engineering. And this is Wednesday Talk Radio.